Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, snow and freezing temperatures raise concerns about the homeless in Charlotte. At the same time, Mecklenburg County conducts its annual census of those folks. Katz lays out four scenarios for what the transit plan might ultimately look like and what each scenario would cost. A federal judge stays a new Trump administration order ending birthright citizenship. Should that ruling be overturned, it will have ramifications in Charlotte and statewide. Meanwhile, convicted January 6th insurrectionists go free. The tussle over the winner in the state Supreme Court race goes to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals on Monday, and CMS prepares for potential ICE arrests. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Mary C. Curtis is back, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Morning, everybody. Welcome back.
Morning.
Good morning. Morning.
So thanks to the vaunted polar vortex, temperatures in this region have been brutally cold, especially to those of us who live here and not in Minnesota, but with temperatures at night being in the teens. Clay Cheney is with the National Weather Service.
We haven't seen temperatures probably this cold since around Christmas of 2022. Even then, the temperatures were colder then, but we just haven't had a really good blast of cold air since then.
And we had a touch of snow for a moment. That resulted in numerous flight delays and cancellations at Douglas International, and both CMS and Union County Public Schools canceled classes on Wednesday, delayed them on Thursday. For CMS, this was the second snow day of the month. After 3 years of going without any snow days, they do this, of course, out of an abundance of caution. But did we experience any major problems on the roads during this snowbageddon?
Well, I think we did see, as usual, as we're used to, a fair amount of derision from folks who started their lives up north. Several people I talked to said, I sent them pictures, and they were like, you can't be serious. You closed school for that. My kids both were born here, and they said, and I quote, "This is the most snow I've ever seen." They were so excited. They made snow angels in the driveway in about a quarter inch of powder. So we didn't have any huge problems. But, you know, again, with the potential for ice on the roads, it was nice to sit at home and have some hot chocolate. So, hey, if we get this every 3 years, that's a nice little break sometimes.
Eric?
I think the best news of the week is there were minimal power outages. The number I saw reported, I think, was maybe a couple of hundred. So that was the thing that was on my mind. And the work from home situation is, please keep the power on. The power stayed on. So that's a good winter storm for me.
Mary.
This is interesting, though, because people who are climate change deniers are saying, how can we have global warming when it's so cold in the South? But the meteorologists are saying, well, this is proof of it because the polar vortex has been pushed down. And that's a real good sign that we are having global warming and climate change. So this was not good for the climate change deniers.
Trust the science. We often get snowfall that doesn't stick or accumulate so slowly that it melts before it sticks. This time, snow accumulated much faster, and the National Weather Service's Rodney Hinson says you can attribute that to the cold that we have been experiencing.
Normally around here, when it snows, it takes a few hours for any accumulations to start, just because even though it's cold, the roads are warm, but this time everything was just cold, so everything started sticking right away.
So it's not going to be as cold this weekend. The temperatures are rising even as we sit here this morning. They're going into the 50s over the weekend. But this week of sub-freezing temperatures with even colder wind chills in some places raised serious concerns about the health and safety of homeless people. Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte activated extreme weather protocols. Well, what is the impact of doing that?
Well, it allows people to access shelters more easily and, more warming locations. I believe Katz was also offering free rides to warming shelters. All you had to do, if you couldn't access one, is get on a bus and say, hey, I need to go to a warming shelter. And then, you know, you can get transportation there because many people who are living on the streets don't have access to vehicles, of course, or money for a bus fare, perhaps. But, you know, when it's this cold out, there are obviously going to be people who suffer severely when they live outside. And, you know, just taking in my trash in the morning, I was getting cold. And this is a really hard time for people who are already living in really hard circumstances.
Which brings us to this, because this cold weather came at the same time that the Mecklenburg County folks conducted their once a year, I think it's once a year, it could be twice
a year.
Point in time count. That's when they count the number of unhoused people on the streets of Charlotte. This year, surveyors discovered one homeless person had died. Liz Clayson Kelly is CEO of Roof Above. That's a nonprofit that combats homelessness and provides shelter resources.
It's one of my just a handful of times I've actually seen a body of someone who's deceased. It was incredibly, I mean, death will come for us all one day, but you don't want for anyone that experience of dying alone outside. It was not fitting of human dignity.
Where was this deceased person found? Do we know the person's identity, the cause of death? What do we know about this?
Well, this was a man who was, I believe, across from First United Methodist Church uptown, sleeping outside. And our reporter, Elvis Menayese, was up at 4 in the morning out there, accompanying the teams who go around, teams of volunteers and county workers who go around and try to, you know, count how many people are out there before they get up and about their day. So this is pretty close to the county's social services offices over there in First Ward. I believe it was on 8th Street. Our reporter did not have the person's identity, the man's identity, as of yesterday. Police arrived, medics arrived, of course, and, you know, began investigating this. There's not a cause of death yet, but it was in the low teens for the third or fourth night. This man was sleeping and living outside. And there's a lot of, you know, that points to that direction. And it was a very, as our reporter Elvis described it, surreal scene, because you're there in uptown Charlotte, literally under the shadows of some of the bank towers, and a person has died sleeping on the sidewalk, and they, you know, took a few minutes to even realize he was dead. So very tragic scene out there.
Talk about this point in time count and how it is conducted and how it is used.
Yeah. So this is something that, you know, the federal government requires and helps allocate how much money, how many resources we get. And communities across the U.S. do this in a similar time frame. So the idea is it's not perfect, but it's sort of an annual snapshot of what it looks like on a single night. And for the last few years, we've seen increases, especially among unsheltered homeless people. Those are people who are living outside. They also count people who are sheltered homeless, which means people who are either staying in a shelter or staying, you know, in somewhere with a roof over their head that's not their permanent residence.
Which leads me to a question I was going to ask after we hear from Mary Ann Priester, who heads the county's point in time count. She says the frigid temperatures this week may impact the numbers that they come up with as a result of this survey, because organizations have already been working to get people off the streets and into shelters.
Because it is extremely cold, we may see less people out there than we typically do.
So because they've gone to the shelters, that affects the count. Don't they count the people who are in the shelters?
They do count them, but they do break it down into sheltered versus unsheltered. And for example, in 2024, last year, they found 384 people who were unsheltered living on the streets. And that was more than double the number from 2022, when they found about 150 people. So that number, even if they go into a shelter, they will be counted in that, but they're not counted as the unsheltered homeless people who are living and sleeping outside.
The county, Mecklenburg County, is conducting the survey officially, but it's actually being conducted. The people out in the field, as I understand it, are community advocacy groups and volunteers. And they're not just counting the number of people living on the streets or under overpasses or in wooded areas close to uptown Charlotte and elsewhere. They are also asking them questions.
We ask questions about domestic violence, what services did they need and couldn't access, what prevented them from being able to access those services, what would make them more likely to use shelter.
So I have all these varying numbers here, Eli. Prior to this count, back in June of last year, it was reported that 2,784 people were experiencing homelessness, up 80%, 80% from a year ago. And last year at this time, as you said, 384 people were experiencing unsheltered homelessness in Mecklenburg County. And you sent Elvis out, our WFAE reporter, to be with the people conducting this survey and asking questions. Did he bring back any personal stories that these folks shared? Why are they homeless? Why are they not in shelters?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a tough question because out of 300 plus people who they might interact with, everyone's got a different story. Some, you know, might involve mental illness or addiction. One lady who Elvis talked to and interviewed said that the lack of transportation is a real issue for her. It's hard to get to job interviews, hard to get to services. And, you know, Charlotte is a very car dependent city. So if you don't have a car, you're starting at a big disadvantage. I think there's going to be year to year fluctuations and differences in the numbers that kind of just happened because this is an imprecise metric by its nature. You're dealing with people who move a lot. But if you look at the overall trends, especially in that unsheltered homeless category, they're not great. You know, in 2019 and 2020, there were about 200 folks both of those years. And like I said, last year, 384, so almost 400. So a lot more people are being found living on the streets outside of shelters in Charlotte. Mm.
And of course, it's relatively easy to go uptown and find people living on the streets because it's you walk down the street and they're laying on the bus benches, they're in crevices and nooks and crannies to stay out of the wind, etc. But that's not the only place the homeless find themselves or find places to be. So how do the people conducting this point in time count find them?
Well, a lot of them are people who work in social services, who are familiar with where homeless folks might tend to camp, and they know kind of the places to go where they are likely to find people. But that's one reason this is an imprecise metric is, you know, you can't find everybody who might be outside, you know, sleeping in a doorway across a 310 square mile city in one night. So there's going to be some impreciseness there no matter what.
So it's a census, but it's not as precise as the United States census, which is based on addresses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When will the numbers be released that they came up with as a result of this point in time survey?
You know, it usually takes a little time to measure and kind of cross-check, correlate everything. I'm not sure. Last year, I feel like it was a couple months later, but they have to, you know, they get identities and cross-check stuff, compile all their data. They also get demographic data, so it's a few weeks to a couple months at least.
You mentioned that some of the folks on the street are on the street because they don't have access to transit or transportation, and that's our next topic because they unveiled four different scenarios for our ever languishing transit plan. And we'll get to that and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFHE, listener-funded public radio. Our guests today on the news roundup are Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, columnist at rollcall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Eli Portillo, senior editor here at WFAE News. Charlotte, you may have heard, has transit dreams. And we've had a transit plan for a while that has morphed over time to reflect many things, among them pushback from leaders at the General Assembly who found our original plan to be too rail-centric, too train-centric, with not enough focus on roads. So they've gone back to the drawing board, and this week CATS unveiled the latest plans, which includes significant improvements to railroads and the bus system, and they included ideas on how all of this would be paid for using a proposed 1 cent sales tax for transit. Did we learn, Eric, anything new?
Oh, we always learn something new. So a couple things. One of the, I guess, the most interesting things for a Business Journal guy and for taxpayers is we learned the updated prices of these projects, which of course affects what can be bought with our 30-year investment if voters approve that 1 cent tax you just mentioned. So a couple of things up front, Mike. There were four scenarios laid out, and this MTC, Metropolitan Transit Commission, is the body that will ultimately choose which menu item they want. They'll do that over the next few months with response and reaction from the public, and then that will be paired with the proposed tax, and the supporters will go out to the public and say, you should support this.
So
other thing we should go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other thing I should mention is these four scenarios, three aspects are in every scenario. In other words, they would be included each time, and they are the $1.4 billion red line, which would go commuter rail from uptown to Iredell County. The second is the completion of the streetcar, another 6 miles east and west, which would cost about $845 million. And then the third component is the bus system improvements, which would include frequency and an updated fleet. And then the final piece that varies in each of these four scenarios is how you do the east-west Silver Line, and also how you do the extension of the existing Blue Line to Pineville and Ballantyne. The variables are, do you use more light rail or new light rail, depending on which circumstance we're talking about, or do you use bus rapid transit, which is kind of a souped-up version of bus service, or do you use a mix? And now I'll stop talking.
Yeah, but that's okay. The Silver Line, because Lee Altman, who is on the Transit Commission, sent an email, not just to me, to a lot of people, and I happened to open it this morning, and it outlines all of these plans. And the Silver Line component of this seems to be the one with the most possible permutations, shall we say. The plan number one, or scenario number one, has future light rail expansion along the Silver Line path. Airport to the Coliseum to Ovens Auditorium is one of the stops, or one of the pathways, and future light rail expansion. The second of those scenarios has the Blue Line, or the Silver Line, rather, going to the airport and then to 11th Street with bus rapid transit taking it further out. And scenarios number three and four are completely bus rapid transit from 485 to CPCC Levine. That's the one that's the sticky wicket, isn't it? Or are they all?
They're all sticky wickets to one degree or another. And the various scenarios that you just outlined and that were presented, it's a simple reason. There's not enough money to build full light rail, and particularly within the constraints of 40% capped on spending on light rail. And remember, that was created by the town managers to take to the legislature in hopes that they would accept this because, as you mentioned, the legislators wanted more spending on roads. So I think the number that really jumped out at me is, on average, it will cost about $350 million per mile of light rail versus $100 million per mile of bus rapid transit.
Why? Why the cost differential?
Well, because you're building, you know, permanent tracks into the ground, which are much more expensive than even some dedicated lanes and buses, as you would have with bus rapid transit. And Mike, I think you were getting at the sticky wicket part here is everybody wants a train. I mean, no matter where you go, everybody wants a train. They don't want bus rapid transit, if they even know what it is, just the word bus makes them recoil. And you heard that from the mayor of Matthews at the meeting the other day. Yeah. And that is seems to be the most likely place where you're going to get bus rapid transit is to the east between Uptown and Matthews. And that's been a contentious conversation for 6-9 months, however long we've been having it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the reason that we are not completely focused on rail, expansion of the Silver Line, Red Line, expansion of the Blue Line, et cetera, is because of what the Senate leader Phil Berger said when he was here, saying it was too transit, too train-centric and not enough attention was being paid to roads. Mecklenburg County Commissioner Lee Altman, who is also a member of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, says she is in favor of the rail-focused plan, but says now is the time to move forward with the plan that can get through the General Assembly and has the support of most of the members of the Transit Commission.
The draft legislation that we hope the General Assembly will take up was passed by the elected officials who represent 97% of this community.
Of course, some of those in the 3% who don't support this plan are folks in Matthews. As you alluded to, this new plan has the new Silver Line stopping short of the town where John Higdon is mayor, and he is extremely frustrated by all of the proposed scenarios.
Well, I just think it's a false narrative to just say those are the only four scenarios that could possibly work. So that's why I voted against even putting it before the public.
And in lieu of the Silver Line, as you said, it would now be bus rapid transit likely to Matthews. And Higdon says that in places where that is the option in other cities, it doesn't work very well. So what message is it going to send to Raleigh, Eli, that not 100% of the members of the Metropolitan Transit Commission are on board with the plan that we are submitting, whatever that plan turns out to be?
Well, it's going to, of course, be less compelling than if there were 100% of people on board. I think bigger picture, for me, the question in Raleigh is, okay, they're starting their new session, their new long session. There's a new Republican House Speaker. You know, there's new members of the Mecklenburg delegation. There's a ton on the agenda when it comes to Hurricane Helene relief and other priorities like that. I'm more interested in whether this gets lost in the shuffle in Raleigh. You know, is there anyone there who's going to pick this up and carry the ball to the finish line? Because keep in mind, Charlotte folks want this to happen really fast. This transit tax depends on getting on the ballot in November for a referendum from voters. And, you know, if they can't get it approved early enough in Raleigh, they're going to be taking a really big risk. Say it's approved late in the session, like June or July, and then you only have a few months to try to slam together a yes campaign in a municipal off year with a plan that's still pretty unsettled, that a lot of people are really skeptical of or have tuned out. It's a big risk the longer it takes. And, you know, keep in mind, we're 5 years into this thing and we're still talking about which lines to prioritize. Right. So the cake is not baked.
Eric.
I think one of the interesting things is just how much political compromise is in this plan. Inherently, transit plans have political compromise, right? Because politicians approve them. But when you look at this one, for example, let's start with the fact that the streetcar extension is in all four scenarios. The streetcar has never come close to meeting any of its ridership projections. And since 2021, when it expanded to 4 miles, they haven't even charged fares, and they still are nowhere near their ridership projections. So this is a transit project that is obviously failing, but you look where it's going to go, east and west sides, that affects political voter support. Certainly the Red Line is all about voter support because you go to North Mecklenburg where they have been staunchly opposed to this. And then the final piece, Mike, is we're talking about that 40% to rail, 20% bus, 40% roads. Well, that was a ratio that was conjured by these town managers in response to, as you mentioned, Phil Berger and then Speaker Tim Moore coming to town saying, well, no, we don't like the proposal you've made, which was 80 to 90% on rail. So clearly, this is just so different than what was originally envisioned.
And so we have these four different plans. We knew about the legislature's objections to our original plan, and we've known about it for about a year, maybe more. And suddenly we have this rush to the finish line, which seems to be a pattern in Charlotte about everything that's an important decision where lots of money has to be spent. We sit on it for years on end, and suddenly it has to be decided tomorrow. And that is essentially the case here. But we have these four unsolidified plans that we are now going to present to the public at large, let them comment on it, then be voted on by the Metropolitan Transit Commission, and then sent to Raleigh. Hopefully, they will find a place on their stack of things to do in enough time to get it on the ballot in November. And Brent Cagle, who is the interim CEO of CATS, told WCNC-TV that what was presented in this week's meeting was a, quote, snapshot of what's possible under the funding limits.
Any of those options, all of those options, whatever the choice is, right, from the community, from the MTC, it will represent significant new investment and enhancements to the region's transit system.
But what do people want? Is that what the purpose of these meetings is going to be?
Yeah, that's the purpose of these meetings. But they've been talking to the public and hearing from them for years and years. And some of that was mentioned by Brent Cagle and others that clearly they want more transit. They want more reliable transit. They want faster transit. And overwhelmingly, they want trains. And I think what you heard from Brent Cagle and Lee Altman and others is we're going to do as much of that as we can, but we have a limited budget and we have to take this opportunity while we have it, because remember, the legislature, as Eli was just pointing out, controls all of it. You can't have a tax referendum without.
Well, I understand that. And they have to say yes to allow us to have the referendum put on the ballot. And then the voters have to say yes to it. But if the voters predominantly want rail, if the members of the Transit Commission who are tasked with supervising all this want rail, who's the General Assembly to say that's not the way we should go? Who the hell do they think they are?
They think they're the General Assembly of North Carolina, okay. A Dillon rule state that controls all of the municipalities.
Just wanted to be clear about that. Okay, it may be taking Charlotte eons to get their transit plan in order, but it's taken Donald Trump no time to act on what he promised he would do in the opening days of his administration. He has pardoned or commuted the sentences of all those arrested, indicted by grand juries, and then tried and convicted in taking part in the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, some of whom are coming home to North Carolina. Mary, what has the reaction been?
Don't you feel safer, Mike? Yes. As I wrote in roll call, Donald Trump was inaugurated. It happened to be on the Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday. And although he name checked him, everything Trump says and does, it's all a repudiation of what King lived and died for. So he released 1,500, as you say, criminals who were adjudicated in our court of law. And the most vicious of them and violent of them are getting off easiest because they had the longer sentences. And one of them happens to be Jeremy Bertino of Gaston County, who wasn't there on January 6th, but he helped plan it. And he wasn't there because he was recovering from a stab wound that he received in a hateful, vicious, racist attack on a Washington, D.C., predominantly Black church. Okay? And he pled guilty in a court of law.
To seditious conspiracy, which is one of the worst crimes you can commit in America.
Very serious crime. He was a Proud Boy, a hateful group. And now Trump has a ready-made thug army with no consequences to do violence if you do it in his name. And this is just an outrage. It's interesting because Democrats have condemned it, and some Republicans have outright, like Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, but others have sidestepped it. And they're saying, well, let's look to the future, which is kind of impossible when the Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has formed a subcommittee to investigate and rewrite history. And the Republican Party can no longer say they back the blue. The Fraternal Order of Police, which endorsed Donald Trump, knowing who he was, has decried and condemned this action. They can no longer say they're the party of law and order. And Trump has remade it. And this is pretty frightening. I don't feel comfortable having these people out on the street. They have not, usually when you get some kind of pardon or redemption, as Mike Johnson likes to say, first you have to have remorse. And none of them do. One woman has said she has, but many of them have said that they really want to retaliate against the people who put them there. One has already been rearrested. So these are not nice people. And this is one of his first acts. And so, as I say, I think it's pretty frightening to know these people are out there knowing that if they do something violent, that Trump has their back.
Of course, I know it depends on which side of the aisle you are on in this current political environment, but this has been described as the greatest abuse of presidential power and the worst strike against the rule of law in our nation's history. I was going to ask you, is it? But the other side points to Joe Biden and his blanket pardon of members of who they refer to as the Biden crime family, which is what they call them. Anyway, they're saying that's equivalent. Is it equivalent? And is this the worst abuse of presidential power in American history?
Well, I will talk to my historian son about the worst, but it's pretty bad because we do have an Office of Pardons that really recommends different folks and investigates who you want to pardon. Donald Trump has bypassed that. He just pardons the people he wants to pardon. As far as Joe Biden, you can say that you don't agree with those particular pardons that he's done and criticize that without saying it's equal to this, because none of these people that he has pardoned, I think it's a false equivalency. And I think people who are doing that are being disingenuous, because we're talking about folks who destroyed property, who attacked police officers. People died on that day. And even those who committed misdemeanors by going into the Capitol, that was breaking the law. And obviously, certain groups of people in this country could not do that. If there were people of color making those attacks, you would not see the same treatment. So I think we all should be afraid.
And it's putting some Republican senators, including our own senior Senator Tom Tillis, in awkward situations. And we'll hear from Senator Tillis on this in a moment. And then we'll talk about birthright citizenship and what Trump's attempts to overturn that constitutional guarantee may have on folks living here. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor for WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for rollcall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. We were talking a moment ago about the Trump pardons of the people who participated in the insurrection on January 6, 2021 at the Capitol. 1,500 people were pardoned without any consideration of what they were convicted of. He commuted the sentences of 14 others, which has essentially neutered 4 years of Justice Department efforts to hold the rioters accountable. North Carolina Senior Senator Tom Tillis spoke with Spectrum News One's Reuben Jones about the decision to pardon everyone rather than making decisions on a case-by-case basis.
We're going through it now. Many of them probably was the right thing to do. They made a bad choice, but anybody who was convicted of assault on a police officer, I can't get there at all. I think it was a bad idea.
Now that goes against Trump, and he's already been censured by the MAGA wing of the Republican Party, and he's up for re-election in 2 years. How many Republican senators or members of the House agree with Tom Tillis?
I think you saw a much more muted reaction. Tillis was probably on the, louder, more outspoken side. But you saw a lot of folks really just get in line and, you know, not object. You saw some members say they supported all this. I think beyond this specific episode, when you look at the Biden pardons and these, you know, the pardon power is by far the most imperial power that the president wields, more than executive orders, more than, you know, directing the Justice Department. Pardon power is stroke of a pen, make things go away like they never happened. And we're definitely seeing a long-term trend towards more and more extreme use of the pardon power. It's hard to imagine, say a Democrat wins in 2028, it's hard to imagine Trump not blanket pardoning everyone in his administration. And then the next Democratic president, it's hard to imagine them not doing that as well. So I think we have a long-term problem with the pardon power here and that, what it means.
And that led Spectrum News One's Reuben Jones to ask Senator Tillis this question about whether or not the Congress should review presidential pardon power.
I think it's a legit question because we can't get into this cycle where presidents are, you know, pardoning their friends, creating prospective pardons for charges that haven't even been applied. I don't think that that's what the founding fathers had in mind when this ability to pardon was first vested in the executive branch.
That was a walk and talk in a stairwell at the Capitol. That's why all those doors were slamming in the background. That power, however, is outlined in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, stating that the president has the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, which this certainly was. And that would make it very difficult, if not nearly impossible, to impose limitations on this, would it not?
Well, you'd have to get a constitutional amendment, I believe. You know, it's been done 27 times before, but it's hard to imagine crossing that threshold right now with our current state politics divisions.
So there was this flurry of other executive orders flying out of the White House this week. Trump signed more than 200 on his very first day in office, including one that would end birthright citizenship. Remind us of what birthright citizenship is.
Well, under the 14th Amendment, you are considered a citizen of the United States if you're born here, unless you are born as the child of diplomats who are, you know, kind of in their special exempt category. It's why they get diplomatic immunity and special license plates. And this was passed after the Civil War when there were arguments about whether freed slaves were citizens. And this was, you know, one of the Reconstruction era amendments that said, hey, you're born here, you're a citizen, we're codifying it, end of story.
So this order, because it's in the 14th Amendment, has already been stayed by a judge who heard arguments on both sides. And as soon as the lawyers had finished speaking, he signed a stay on this, saying it was blatantly unconstitutional. That suit was brought by 19 Democratic attorneys general, including our Jeff Jackson here in North Carolina, who says, quote, the Constitution leaves no room for executive reinterpretation on this matter. It is clear, settled, and binding. So this will surely go ultimately to the United States Supreme Court. But let's talk a moment about how this might affect people here. About 150,000 non-citizens live in Mecklenburg County, more than 500,000 in the state. If this order is upheld, their future children will not automatically become citizens. But is it would it be retroactive? Would those already born, if the Supreme Court decides in Trump's favor, would those already born have their citizenship stripped from them?
No, not under this order. This order applies to people born after it takes effect.
Mary.
Yes, some people have called this Trump's getting back at Kamala Harris because, you know, both of her parents were not citizens when she was born. But it would affect some himself and some other folks in his administration. But we see already that they are doing raids on places and cities. We saw it in Newark. And in some of these raids, they're not really raiding the employers, but they're going to different places of business. And they've actually, the sweep has caught up people who are citizens. Yeah. And folks will have to show their ID. A military veteran had to show his ID. So you see this that's one of the executive orders you were talking about, because this whole sense of immigration and this birthright citizenship is part of that. So you can see a place where people will have to carry their ID and show their papers, and neighbors would be reporting on neighbors. And this judge, by the way, that stated was a Ronald Reagan appointee. So we can't say this was some white. He said, you know, expect look at the judge who did it. Well, he's a very conservative judge if you look at it. But this is one way you can see that he's going to be going after things like constitutional amendments. And with everything, the courts in his control, the Supreme Court, people are being very wary of it. The ACLU and other organizations are really gearing up to fight it every step of the way in the states.
So North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson says that if this order somehow stands, it remains, quote, unclear how North Carolina parents would be able to document and prove that their newborns are American citizens, since North Carolina birth certificates may not contain the necessary information to satisfy the requirements of this executive order. And immigration attorney Jamila Espinosa says that it's likely to be a mess.
What we are going to see is a lot of confusion even within our community at the local level. You have the hospitals and the register of deeds that are going to have to try to figure out how to implement this. And that is not an easy system.
So ending birthright citizenship was one of Trump's campaign promises, as was mass deportation of all undocumented immigrants. This week, the administration said that churches and schools would no longer be safe havens for undocumented individuals. It was a reversal of a Biden-era policy that prohibited ICE detentions at schools, churches, and hospitals. And Liz Monterey, a member of the CMS school board, told WFAE education reporter Julian Berger that this could have a negative impact on attendance.
This reversal is deeply troubling. This decision may discourage families from sending their children to school or seeking critical resources, which could lead to even higher absenteeism and dropouts.
The Department of Homeland Security will now allow ICE to conduct arrests at schools and expect local law enforcement officials to use, quote, common sense to aid in deportations. Is this plan to send officers into schools during class time to arrest children? Is that the plan?
No, we have not seen that. Up until now, what we've had is, I believe, actually for the past decade plus, a system where churches, hospitals, schools, weddings, religious celebrations were off limits to ICE. And now what the Department of Homeland Security said is, hey, we're not going to put those blanket rules in place. We're not going to say this is a place you just can't go. What they are saying is we're replacing that with use common sense. Now, school systems are preparing for this across the U.S. Liz Monterey and the CMS board, they were actually set to discuss this at a committee meeting at 11 o'clock this morning. But they've canceled that meeting and said they need more time to prepare. Undocumented children, basically under a 1982, I think, Supreme Court case, Plyler versus Doe, are legally entitled to enroll in schools and receive education. So that's a Supreme Court precedent that's not changing. So schools don't know, you know, they don't have records, like they don't ask you for your citizenship when you enroll. I think a bigger concern is parents picking kids up, parents, you know, gathering there, because even if ICE decides not to go in a school, well, they can wait on the sidewalk, the road. Latino does not equal undocumented. I think it's important to say that. But at the same time, Latinos are the second largest group of students in CMS. So it's a concern for a lot of families around here.
The stated reason for this policy is to deport people who should not be here in the first place, in his opinion, in Trump's opinion. But what he does really is traffic in fear. That's everything he does is about fear of something, of reprisal. There are 140,000 students in CMS alone. They come from 175 different countries. And the school board's Liz Monterey says the system is taking a close look at this new directive in order to prepare.
I want the community to know that we're working on this, that we're navigating this. This is new waters for us. And I want everyone to remain calm.
That's a tall order in the face of this, one assumes. But really, what can school systems here or anywhere else do in the face of this?
Well, yeah, one thing. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
So, and a part of this, too, as Eli was saying, if they pick up the parents of the Trump official was asked, what then happens to the children? Maybe they're there. And he said, well, there's always foster care. But that's another complication that would happen if they did indeed start picking people up. And it's interesting to note that the shock and awe of them going in on these raids, it's really resulted in the pretty much exact same number of folks that were being deported in the Biden administration.
Yeah, yes, and, Eli? You know, schools are, in some cases, printing out rights cards, not here locally, but in Chicago, for example, they are printing out Know Your Rights cards, telling people, make sure you know, you don't have to speak to law enforcement agents, you don't have to open the door without a warrant. So there are educational efforts like that underway in a lot of school systems in major cities.
And in Chicago, they're also putting transit advertising in the buses to know your rights. One presumes that it's in Spanish. We have been following the outcome of the North Carolina Supreme Court race between incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs and Republican challenger Judge Jefferson Griffin since election night. Riggs won that race on election night. She has won it in two recounts that have taken place since then. She's a winner by 734 votes, but as we talked about earlier this week, Griffin has been challenging this in the courts, attempting to get as many as 60,000 votes, and now he's focusing on 5,000 votes disqualified. And on Monday, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments in this case. It's a federal court, and there have been questions about which court should have jurisdiction, federal or state. So how did it end up at the Fourth Circuit?
Well, it's also in the state system. The state Supreme Court and, trial courts in North Carolina are also hearing an appeal. Basically, Griffin went to the state courts. The Board of Elections has gone to the federal courts and said, hey, you should have jurisdiction here. You should hear it. Both of them, are trying to find the court that's more likely to be sympathetic to them. I think, one question I'm wondering is which is done first, Charlotte's transit plan or this, because neither one seems like they're ever going to end.
So we spent an hour on this. I believe it was yesterday's program. Yeah. And Mary, you wrote about this in one of your recent columns, that when Democrat Sherry Beasley lost to now Republican Chief Justice Paul Newby, she lost by only 401 votes, which are fewer votes than Judge Griffin has lost by in this election. But she lost and she conceded. What is happening now could be viewed as sore loser, not taking no for an answer, or as someone fighting for what he truly believes are votes that should be ineligible because the voters didn't have Social Security numbers or other means of identification now required on file. Which is it?
Well, I doubt that if he had won under the current system with the current vote total that he would have said, but let's check and make sure I really won. He's going after overseas ballots, things that he says are incomplete. People who never lived in North Carolina. Folks have looked at the analysis, thinks it targets youth, the youth vote, people of color. And he hasn't really spoken about it publicly. He's just filed these lawsuits. So people are saying, why don't you come out and defend what you're doing? And I think the answer is because really he can't. And even one of the Republican judges on the North Carolina Supreme Court has said, you don't do this after all these people have voted already. As usual, North Carolina is in the center of a scandal nationally and news that we don't want. We're the last statewide undecided vote in this country.
Really short on time. Eric first, then Eli.
I was just going to say real quickly, and also he also wants those votes just thrown out for his race, not other races, which is an interesting wrinkle.
And that raises a question that I raised yesterday. You can hear our whole hour on this on WFAE.org or our podcast. But the question is, if he's successful in having 5,000 or 60,000 votes thrown out, what happens to the people who voted in that race who no longer count for the races who have been decided and positions already taken in government? Do we do that again for everybody, or we just ignore that? That's the big question.
Yeah, and Steve Harrison, our political reporter, talked to a woman yesterday who has voted for 14 years with no problems and is now on this challenged list. So there's a lot of folks like that.
Finally, one of our guests on Wednesday's program, this is Red Letter Week for Charlotte Talks. One of our guests on Wednesday's program, Sam Dimenich of Restaurant Constance, has been announced as the James Beard Award semifinalist. He's been named or nominated for Best Chef Southeast. And two other Charlotte restaurateurs are also semifinalists. Colleen Hughes of Supperland is up for Outstanding Professional Cocktail Service. And Shaheel, I hope I say this name right, Shaheel Johnson from Community Matters Cafe joins Dimenich in the competition for Best Chef Southeast. So congratulations and good luck to them all. Eli Portillo from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.